So it's kind of ironic, you know, in this incredible world of molecular technology and mutations and all these things, that we're kind of also coming back to histopathology and, you know, just the diagnosis of squamous cell carcinoma versus something other. And Corey, we asked you to briefly review why histology right now makes a difference in terms of management in non-small cell.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm going to look at the emerging implications of histology and molecular diagnostics in advanced non-small cell. We're all familiar with the histologic imperative. It's only really been in the last 6 to 7 years that histology has really made a difference in our therapeutic decision-making. And this will be expanded in great detail by Dr. Sosinski shortly. Adenocarcinoma, about 50% are mucin positive. 75% are positive for thyroid transcription factor. Very few other epithelial malignancies beyond lung cancer and thyroid harbor that marker. Squamous cell, the typical keratinization, intracellular bridges with keratin pearls. Here we have a relatively newly used marker, P63, which is present in about 2/3 of patients. So as you'll see shortly, it's quite important to make this distinction. Squamous cell tends to have a more central presentation, a higher incidence of local regional recurrence, particularly after surgery or chemoradiation. Much lower relative incidence of metastatic spread, relatively more common in men and smokers and in Eastern Europe, and declining incidence overall. If you go back 25, 30 years, squamous actually exceeded adenocarcinoma in incidence. Adenocarcinoma is more often peripheral, a higher incidence of metastatic spread. It's linked to tobacco, but not quite as tightly as small cell or squamous cell, and its incidence is going up, particularly overall in women. As Dr. Sosinski will show you, histology has really emerged as a determinant of treatment, particularly with respect to bevacizumab and pemetrexed. This is the landmark 4599 trial, which isolated the role of bevacizumab in combination with standard chemo and showed a statistically significant, I'd argue clinically meaningful improvement in median 1 and 2 year survival for the bevacizumab arm. Remember, squamous cell was not included in this group because of evidence of a high rate of hemorrhage in the prior randomized phase 2 trials. And then the Scagliotti trial, which compared pemetrexed to gemcitabine in combination with cisplatin, one of the largest trials ever mounted in advanced non-small cell, over 1,700 patients, ostensibly a non-inferiority trial, but Giorgio Scagliotti had the presence of mind to include a pre-specified histology analysis based on the assumption that TS levels would be lower in adeno and that these patients might be relatively more sensitive to pemetrexed. So you see the overall curves, no major surprise, it did meet its primary endpoint. But in fact, in the non-squamous population, you do see an advantage for cis-pem over cis-gemcitabine with a hazard ratio just over 0.8. Conversely, in the squamous population, you actually see an advantage for gemcitabine over pemetrexed. The first time we've ever seen histology make a difference just in the choice of platinum doublets in advanced disease. So certainly based on these two trials, the use of PEM and bevacizumab limited to non-squamous histology. The standard platform, at least in the US for squamous cell, is platinum plus either gem or a taxane. The standard cytotoxic platform for adeno is platinum plus either PEM or taxane. And the elderly will often use carbo combined with weekly paclitaxel or carbo and pemetrexed. Just 2 years ago at this meeting, Mark Chris, on behalf of the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium, presented what I consider to be one of the landmark analyses. This was the identification of driver mutations in tumor specimens from over 1,000 patients. Quite an effort. This was a consortium of 14 major cancer centers. The data, KRAS, as we would predict, was present in just over 20% of patients, EGFR mutations in 17%, EML4-ALK in 7%, and a number of other potentially actionable molecular abnormalities were also identified. Now, KRAS we've known about for 25 years. Some would consider that a negative predictor because these are essentially mutually exclusive. So if that's positive, it's unlikely the patient's going to have an EGFR mutation or translocation of EML4-ALK. But nevertheless, at this meeting, you will see some data suggesting that perhaps KRAS may in fact be actionable. Overall, over 50% of the tumor specimens had some either actionable or potentially actionable mutation or molecular abnormality. And the consortium has linked these results to specific trials, which I think is really the future of therapeutic research. We need to identify these molecular abnormalities a priori so we can put patients on appropriate therapeutic trials and not put them on agents that are unlikely to do much benefit. EGFR mutation, Tom Lynch will go over this in quite a bit more detail. The somatic activating mutation of EGFR tends to make patients hyper-responsive to the TKIs, both gefitinib and erlotinib. Exons 19 and 21 are the most common, about 90% of patients. Most other mutations are associated with resistance. And as far as I'm concerned, although lung cancers look alike phenotypically, certainly radiographically, this is a separate entity and needs to be treated as such. The other important message is you can see this in patients who have smoked quite a bit, and I would not exclude testing even in an adenocarcinoma with 50, 60, 70 pack years. The incidence of mutations as high as 4-9% in that group, and it goes up quite a bit as the number of pack years declines. So in some series, 50% or more of patients will have these mutations even in the setting of smoking history. And then the other actionable target, of course, is a translocation of EML4-ALK, the fusion protein. About 3-7% of patients, phenotypically, they look very similar to those with EGFR mutations, adenocarcinoma, tend to be never smokers, a slightly higher prevalence of men, and amazing responses that virtually everyone on this panel and many of you have seen with the MET inhibitor, crizotinib. And again, there are several other agents that will be discussed at this meeting with some activity. Squamous, Dr. Sequist will go in a lot more detail, but this is somewhat the wallflower at the dance. Exclusions for bevacizumab based on safety signals, lack of efficacy, at least with pemetrexed. But there are the potential emergence of new therapies focusing on fibroblast growth factor, ipilimumab, so some of the immunologic strategies that Tom Lynch alluded to, and PARP inhibitors. And here are the pies as they exist now. Squamous used to be a single round circle, but we're beginning to divvy that up. FGF amplifications may be present upwards of 20% or so. So I'll end here, and I guess we have further discussion.